This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 12, 2004. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. U.S. and coalition forces seek to crush continuing uprisings in Iraq. Halliburton fails to account for almost $2 billion worth of work. And John Kerry takes an ambiguous stand on gays in the military.
The Pentagon has actually fired more people over the last 6 years for being gay in many job categories than they're actually recalling now.
But first, these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The California Supreme Court has ruled that San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom exceeded his authority when he ordered the city to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Kelly Aramaras reports from Oakland.
The seven-member court unanimously ruled that a government official generally has no authority to disregard a statutory mandate based on the official's own determination that the statute is unconstitutional. The court declared the nearly 4,000 marriages performed earlier this year in San Francisco to be void and of no legal effect. Two justices dissented from this part of the opinion. They preferred to leave the marriages in legal limbo, pending a ruling on the constitutionality of California laws that currently restrict marriage to heterosexual couples. A case raising that issue is now making its way through California's lower courts. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez in Oakland, California.
Federal negotiators are reportedly working with the legal representative of Yasser Hamdi to possibly release the U.S. citizen that the Supreme Court ruled must be tried on U.S. soil rather than in a military tribunal. Grace Anderson reports from D.C.
Current negotiations with the U.S. government Justice Department could possibly free a U.S. citizen who has been held for more than 2 years as a so-called enemy combatant without charge of any crime. Yasser Hamdi's recent appointed federal public defender is negotiating the possible terms of release. In exchange for his freedom, U.S. officials are asking Hamdi to renounce his U.S. citizenship, move to Saudi Arabia, and agree to be monitored by Saudi officials. Moreover, Hamdi is being asked to forfeit his right to sue the U.S. government for violating his civil rights. U.S. Government Justice Department has stated that Hamdi's current imprisonment has lasted long enough to consider him less of a threat to national security. This could be considered an attempt by the government to purge Hamdi's case from the headlines. According to Dr. Scott L. Silliman at Duke University's Center for Law, Ethics, and National Security, currently, the trial has been put off for 21 days while negotiations take place.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Grace Anderson.
The second highest court in Britain ruled that evidence obtained by torture could be used as long as British officials did not procure or connive the torture. One human rights lawyer said the decision is tantamount to contracting out the torture. The case involves 10 men suspected of being involved with terrorists who are being held without charge in what has been called Britain's Guantanamo Bay. One of the judges supporting the decision said in a statement released yesterday, assuming the evidence came from torture or any other violation of human rights is purely hypothetical. And today, British government officials are proposing more sweeping changes to police powers that many say continues the attack on civil liberties. Naomi Fowler has more from the United Kingdom.
The government's 30-page consultation paper builds on extra powers granted to police by anti-terrorism legislation. The proposals allow police to arrest for non-imprisonable offences such as dropping litter and graffiti. They would allow police to take DNA and fingerprint samples covertly and overtly at roadsides, create legislation to deal with demonstrations outside Parliament, extend search warrants to cover all properties connected to a suspect, and grant greater powers for community support officers. The announcement comes just a couple of weeks after statistics showed a 300% rise in the number of Asian people being stopped and searched by police. This is Naomi Fowler in the United Kingdom for Free Speech Radio News.
Environmentalists charge the Bush administration with changing key legal safeguards and destroying thousands of acres of previously protected wetlands. Erica McDonald explains.
Today's wetlands report is the first to examine the impacts of a 2003 rule that stripped more than 20 million acres of wetlands from Delaware to New Mexico of Clean Water Act protections. Administration officials base the rule change on their interpretation of a 2001 Supreme Court decision on isolated wetlands. Isolated wetlands are those which do not cross state boundaries, and last year, the administration removed them from the jurisdiction of the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The report, Reckless Abandon, presents 15 case studies where the two federal permitting agencies have allowed developers or failed to stop polluters from destroying wetlands in environmentally sensitive areas. One of the most dramatic cases involved wetlands on the shore of Galveston Bay. The Bush directive slashed federal jurisdiction, allowing for the construction of a container port terminal. Natural Resources Defense Counsel's Daniel Rosenberg, an author of the report, called the Bush policy, quote, indescribably mindless. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Erica McDonald.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the U.S. military, along with its Iraqi counterparts, began a major offensive against the forces of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the holy city of Najaf. Using tanks, helicopters, warplanes, and several thousand U.S. troops, the offensive, backed by the Iraqi interim government, is seeking to crush a rebellion that has disrupted oil exports in the southern region of Iraq. In the southern Iraqi city of Kut, over 72 people have been reportedly killed in U.S. air raids, and another 25 people were killed in clashes in Baghdad. Thousands of people took to the streets to protest the offensive in Baghdad and in the southern city of Basra. This newest U.S.-led military intervention has led some Iraqi Americans and peace activists to question if the U.S. military is serious about building the peace. Mitch Jezerich has the story from Washington, D.C.
U.S. Marines reportedly have seized the holy Iraqi city of Najaf, where they say they believe, after raiding the home of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, that the rebellion's leader is entrapped in the Iman Ali Mosque. In a press conference streamed over the internet, Iraqi ministers said that it will be Iraqi troops who will eventually enter the mosque and not U.S. forces. Iraqi ministers say that every effort to include Sadr in a political process was only met with violence.
We have tried to seek a peaceful solution, a political solution, but these forces
have failed.
Some say that these events were instigated by the closure of a certain newspaper by al-Sadr, but this newspaper was reissued, but the violence did not stop.
In Baghdad, in the southern city of Basra, thousands of people reportedly protested against the offensive. In London, for medical treatment, the Grand Ayatollah Sistani condemned the attacks and called for a ceasefire. The Arab League of United Nations Ambassador Yahya Mamasani told CNN that it would have been better to avoid the offensive.
I don't think any military action or violence will solve the problem of the new Iraq. This sort of path they are following now will lead to further violence, to further it will inflame further feelings. And I don't think it augurs well if you want to build a new Iraq. This is not the proper way.
This is the first major offensive by the U.S. military since partial authority was handed over to an Iraqi interim government. The appointed Iraqi prime minister and former CIA operative Iyad Alawi is fully backing the attacks.
Not that I am a fan of the al-Sadr militia, but this is not the way to supposedly build a new post-Saddam Iraq that resembles anything democratic.
Iraqi-American Sinan Antoun is a professor of Arabic literature at Dartmouth College. He is also a co-producer of the new documentary called About Baghdad.
In the return of Iyad Alawi, and this is a government made, cooked and hatched in a Ba'athist kitchen. So for people, as I said, this is really a nightmare, because after all of the destruction, it's true that Saddam is behind bars, but you have the same Ba'athist people who have the same methodology, same practices, ruling over Iraq. And on top of all of that, you've lost all services, you've lost public safety, you've lost everything.
Najaf is a heavily populated city. The last time the U.S. attacked an urban Iraqi city with gunships and heavy artillery was in the spring in Fallujah, where over 600 people were killed. Joe Stork with Human Rights Watch says he will be closely watching this new round of attacks.
Two people engaged in armed combat, they have an obligation to protect civilians, to certainly not target civilians, and to take all necessary precautions to see that there are not attacks which indiscriminately harm civilians. So So that would be a message we'd want to see go to both the U.S. forces involved, the Iraqi government forces involved, and the insurgent.
The anti-war group Voices in the Wilderness has begun actions against the attacks. In Chicago on Thursday, several members of the group have gone to the campaign office of Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry to call on him to speak out against the attacks. One of the organizers, Jeff Lays, says that they will risk arrest by not leaving Kerry's office unless their demands are met.
If indeed this military action ends in only 4 or 5 days, it says, and if that's the projection of our military, it really says a lot about the type of tactics that our military is planning to use in Najaf. And we have to, around the country, we need to increase our resistance to that.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
A new Pentagon audit concludes Halliburton failed to adequately account for almost $2 billion of its work in Iraq and Kuwait. At least one critic says this latest news undermines original claims that privatization of military contracts could save taxpayers' money. Renee Feltz reports.
Auditors at the Pentagon have yet to release a report which questions 43% of the billing by Halliburton for work in Iraq and Kuwait. The Wall Street Journal obtained a copy of the Pentagon's August 4th audit, which concluded the largest U.S. contractor in Iraq inadequately billed the Pentagon for $1.8 billion. Halliburton told the Journal it disputes the Pentagon's claims that the company does not have a system in place adequate to produce proposals on which to negotiate a final price. To date, Halliburton's subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root, or KBR, has billed the Pentagon for $4.18 billion to feed and house U.S. troops with taxpayer dollars. The Center for Corporate Policy's Charlie Cray puts the current charges into context for taxpayers.
Back after the first Gulf War, when he was the Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney hired KBR to do a study which justified the privatization of military support services on the basis that it would free up troops to essentially do battle instead of having to do KP duty and other services. And the taxpayers at the same time have been assured that their money would be used more efficiently. And clearly what we are seeing is so much waste, fraud, and abuse that it undermines the original claims that privatization and giving contracts out to the vice president's old cronies at Halliburton would essentially save the taxpayers' money and provide for a more efficient fighting force.
Vice President Dick Cheney was Halliburton's chief executive from 1995 to 2000. Analysts cited by corporate media have downplayed the Pentagon audit's findings, suggesting it is only newsworthy for Democrats during an election year. Cray responds that no other companies have been charged with wasting over $1 billion in Iraq.
The U.S. taxpayers, whether they're from one party or the other, expect accountability, not $1.8 billion in waste of their money.
The Pentagon audit's findings could threaten services KBR provides to U.S. troops in Iraq and Kuwait. While the Pentagon is unlikely to do anything retroactively, it could start withholding more than $600 million in payments. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
5 years after a white supremacist went on a shooting spree, injuring 5 people at a Jewish community center and killing a Filipino postal worker, some laws are beginning to change. In June, the U.S. Senate passed legislation that broadened the categories of bias to include sexual orientation, gender, and disability, in addition to race, religion, and national origin. The bill would enable the Department of Justice to assist local hate crime prosecutions or carry out its own investigation and prosecution. In California, the state legislature is considering a measure that would standardize the current hodgepodge of anti-hate crime provisions in the civil and penal codes. From KPFK in LA, FSRN's Nak Nguyen reports.
Korean drummers and dancers fill a cathedral in downtown Los Angeles with a sorrowful song. The interfaith service commemorates the 5th anniversary of a hate-motivated shooting rampage that killed Joseph Santos Aleto, a Filipino postal carrier. Buford Furrow went on a shooting spree at the North Valley Jewish Community Center in Chatsworth, injuring 5 people, including 3 boys and an elderly woman. An hour later, on the street, he shot Joseph Aleto twice and 7 times in the back. Furro then fled to Las Vegas, where he turned himself into the police the next day. He confessed to the crimes, saying he killed Aleto because of the color of his skin. Ishmael Aleto is Joseph's brother.
There are many misguided individuals or groups, and you know, the concept of hating somebody just because of their background is still, you know, it still puzzles us. We still wonder how someone can have so much hate in them to do such things. We just think that some groups need to be more educated on different communities and backgrounds, and I guess some of the fear is not knowing somebody.
Ishmael says the media focused on the Jewish victims and their families and overlooked his brother. He says his family had to learn to speak up about the hate crime directed at the Filipino man.
I think it comes from fear. It comes from people being threatened.
Dan Wang coordinates the Hate Crime Prevention Project at the Asian Pacific American Legal Center. The group represents the Aleto family. Huang says people tend to fear change.
You saw this in the San Gabriel Valley back in the 1980s, 1990s, when a lot of Asian immigrants started moving in. And all of a sudden, I think when there were just a few immigrants, you know, most people did not feel threatened by them. But when a lot of people who looked a certain way moved in, it was easy to blame some of the discomforts that people felt by their community changing on some very unfounded ideas. For instance, you know, stereotypes about Asian Americans.
Huang says sometimes government enacts policy that can be discriminatory, thus reinforcing people's stereotypes. For example, in a post-9/11 climate, the federal government ordered special registration drives targeting primarily Arab, Muslim, and Middle Eastern young male adults.
People out there who felt that this entire group of people deserved to be labeled as somehow connected to terrorists saw those policies that were taking place and said, you know, our ideas aren't that illegitimate. The government is clearly acting upon them, so they must have some evidence to support why they're acting on that. And so, you know, we have a right to feel this way and to try to justify our own discrimination based on these ideas.
Dr. Maher Hathout is spokesperson for the Islamic Center of Southern California. He said during the roundup, the Muslim American community received a lot of support, not hate violence. But he says discriminatory policies against Muslim Americans continue.
People are asking these questions. You mean that if I go to Disneyland and I take pictures of Orange County sightseeing, then my visa ran out, I find myself on the press conference of Mr. Ashcroft? People don't know what it means. It means that your neighbor don't want to talk to you. If you are a physician, you lose your patients. You become a plague.
At the memorial service in downtown Los Angeles, the UCLA Filipino chorus, Tinig Choir, sing, "The morning is still far away. Even if it is still dark outside, we are still waiting, hoping that tomorrow there will be new light." 5 years later, Joseph's mother, Lillian Aleto, is still living with a legacy of hate.
I was scared because I have children, and especially Ismail is also doing the same kind of job, though he worked for the UPS. So you're scared of the everyday life because you don't know what kind of person you'll be encountering. So it's kind of like you have a phobia to go out. You just want to stay inside the house.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Na Quen in Los Angeles.
John Kerry has changed his campaign website to make his position on gays in the military more ambiguous. The campaign made the move after the Orlando Sentinel reported the Democratic candidate supports allowing gays and lesbians to serve. Before the change, the website said bringing gays into the military was one of Senator Kerry's priorities. The page on sexual equality had gone on to say, quote, John Kerry opposed the Clinton administration's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He was one of the few senators to testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee and call on the president to rescind the ban on gay and lesbian service members, unquote. Kerry does not mention the issue in his speeches, and the Democratic Party platform is mute on gays in the military. FSRN's Aaron Glantz has more.
John Kerry may no longer be talking about lifting the ban on gays in the military, but for Aaron Belkin, ending the policy of don't ask, don't tell is critical to our national security. Belkin is an assistant professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he's director of the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military.
The Pentagon has actually fired more people over the last 6 years for being gay in many job categories than they're actually recalling now. They're involuntarily recalling about 5,600 service members who had already left the military, who are civilians. This has been referred to as a backdoor draft because the Pentagon is so short of talent in the Middle East. And when you line up the people who they're bringing back involuntarily next to the job specialties that they've fired, you can see that they could have avoided a lot of the involuntary recalls altogether had they not been firing people all these years for being gay.
Belkin says soldiers have been fired in nearly every specialty critical to George Bush's war on terror,
such as Arabic language specialists, infantrymen, nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare specialists, military police, security officials, engineers, you name it, we fired them for being gay and lesbian.
According to the Servicemen's Legal Defense Network, which represents gay and lesbian soldiers, more than 10,000 men and women have been kicked out of the military because of their sexual orientation since Bill Clinton signed Don't Ask, Don't Tell a decade ago. The organization says harassment is endemic, with gay and lesbian soldiers who try to keep quiet harassed till they come out and then kicked out. Since George Bush became president, the organization's Steve Rall says not a single commander has been prosecuted for harassment.
So when a service member finds, as one of SLDN's clients recently did, a live grenade and a death threat taped to his door, you're then confronted with the question of, do I want to sacrifice my career or do I want to sacrifice my life? And at that point, many service members elect to leave the service rather than continue to endure that treatment.
I was not really prepared for the feeling of isolation that I had over there. It was not fun.
Captain Austin Rook has just returned from the Middle East, where he served a tour of duty in the Army Special Ops Unit. For 6 months leading up to the invasion of Iraq, he ran intelligence between Central Command and Special Ops. As a burly man from Alabama, he confounded stereotypes so no one knew he was gay. Now that he's finished his tour, Austin Rook is working for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force in Washington. Austin Rook signed up for the military to get money for college. He considers his experience a best-case scenario.
Sex is permitted between straight people in the Army. The don't tell part of don't ask, don't tell means don't tell anyone. So don't tell your mom, don't tell your dad, don't tell your best friend. So you can be kicked out regardless of who you tell. So you're basically, you're living in this, you know, quasi-legal status. You're not legally permitted to be in the military. So you're serving illegally, and anyone that doesn't like you or has, you know, an axe to grind or and finds that out has power over you.
Like many critics of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Austin Rook isn't angry at John Kerry for staying silent on gays in the military this election year. Civil rights activists note it would take an act of Congress to repeal the policy, which is not likely as long as the House and Senate are controlled by conservative Republicans. Professor Aaron Belkin says silence on the issue has become the norm among both political parties since the issue is seen as too hot to handle. But Belkin thinks public opinion has changed since Bill Clinton signed Don't Ask, Don't Tell 10 years ago.
What the polls show, according to Gallup, a December 2003 poll, is that 79% of the country, including 68% of conservatives, say that gays should be allowed to serve openly. Now, when 79% of the country says that gays should be allowed to serve openly, what that means is that all it's going to take is a little bit of courage from some political leader. And I think that they actually would have a much easier time than they might imagine in changing this policy. The reason that we're not going to see that for quite a while is that both parties imagine themselves to be in this stalemate where they don't face a political incentive for shifting the policy. But in fact, I think their imaginations are wrong.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
August 12 is International Youth Day. Worldwide, it is estimated that more than 300,000 children under the age of 18 are fighting in armed conflicts, and about 250,000 are engaged in child labor. At the third international gathering of the World Youth Festival, nearly 10,000 young people from around the world are meeting to share their ideas on how to push youth policies in their countries. FSRN's Avishay Artsy files this report from Barcelona, Spain.
It's been a nonstop week of dialogue and networking between groups attending the World Youth Festival here in Barcelona, Spain, bringing together the likes of local Catalonian activists and groups ranging from Palestinian youth organizations to a Sahrawi delegation petitioning for an end to the Moroccan occupation. Morocco annexed the former Spanish colony in the 1970s. The World Court ruled that the people of Western Sahara have the right to self-determination, but a UN-organized referendum has been repeatedly postponed by Morocco. Ahmed Sid Ali explains why the Sahrawi independence movement can benefit from international support.
I think it's very important to widen the solidarity between the youth organizations and especially to sensibilize the Catalan society about the Western Sahara issue. And there are many institutions and many NGOs, Catalans, visiting the campus regularly, and they have been collaborating projects there.
In 1998, the United Nations General Assembly declared August 12th to be International Youth Day. This year's theme is Youth in an Intergenerational Society. The UN says that with a growing population of those under 25 and those over 65, solidarity between generations is essential. UN Undersecretary General for Communications and Public Information, Shashi Tharoor, explains.
Youth are one half of the world's population. It's important to understand that for them to succeed, there are major obstacles to be overcome: HIV, AIDS, drug abuse, crime, uneducation, unemployment, and so on. And at the same time, dependence and solidarity between generations is extremely important.
Nima Harry Mwakabonga is a 26-year-old from Tanzania. She says the main problems facing the youth in her country are unemployment, illiteracy, and HIV/AIDS. But there aren't many Tanzanian youth groups working on these issues. She says her delegation hopes to get ideas from other people's experiences in order to tackle the problems in their own communities.
What we are doing is asking other people, how are they doing to minimize those problems in their respective countries? So we are just learning so that when we go back home, we try to implement what we have learned from others.
While the festival participants say a number of important issues have been raised, few solutions are being offered. A Serbian 24-year-old, Branislav Tomis, came to the festival on his own. He says the festival's theme of multiculturalism is merely preaching to the converted, and more efforts need to be made to reach out to those outside the fold.
Mostly tolerant people come here, and we can share ideas in everything, but we are not a majority, and that's the main issue. I listened to various workshops and lectures, and nobody really mentioned, you know, how to involve other people who don't want to be in a certain organization.
One participant in a panel discussion on racism and cultural diversity was Kay Ann Hall, a 20-year-old student from Guyana. She says the discussion created so much interest that more students will be meeting to put together an anti-racist strategy.
The group that I was part of, the panel, we are actually going to sit together, share our ideas before the forum is over so that we can all take something back from our discussion. We're planning to organize an even bigger discussion in the campground so that we can have persons come together and share with us.
The festival's celebration of International Youth Day will culminate in a march tonight under the banner Let's Build the World. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Avishai Artsy reporting in Barcelona.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.